very important meeting. It is a meeting where we will be receiving a briefing from the Human Science Research Council, one of our key stakeholders, on the 2017 appropriation bill. The Human Science Research Council is an important and valued partner to the Appropriations Committee as we work together to ensure that we maximize the socio-economic benefits of the scarce resources available to our people. Previous inputs from the Human Science Research Council, such as accelerating inclusive growth, curbing personnel spending, improving public school education, addressing the challenge of non-communicable diseases, and many others, were agreed to by the committee, and recommendations on these areas made to and accepted by the government. Indeed, the committee recommendations have been acknowledged as comprehensive and valuable. Thanks to the council, we now have to all of the parliament ensure implementation needs for the ticket. So as we continue with our quarterly expenditure report and review, I think we should make sure these are our areas of focus to make sure it goes into implementation. Well, it is a fact that we are confronted by difficult times, and the allocation of our limited resources demands the greatest care and research evidence to ensure that we approve budgets that are transformative and that improve the lives of our citizens. Of course, with the limited budget, we also expect and impact, because there isn't a budget. So from that very limited budget, they work in the key for us to ensure that there is an impact. So with these few words, I welcome the HSRC, and please be open and free. We welcome innovative ideas for effective budget creation. Honourable members, let's have a fruitful and robust engagement. I thank you. We will then move on to the next item, which is apologies.
Madam Chairperson, Honourable members, we receive two apologies from Mr. Zambini, and to the Honourable Members. Also, Mr. Mungu,
Honourable Member Matoki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just send a
Honourable Member Sima.
Thank you, Chair. I want to do this because I like my
debate.
Yes, we accept the apologies, and the whole commission demands it well in the house.
Shall we then proceed to item number 3, which is presentation by Human Science Research Council. Over to you, sir. But maybe we should move introduction. Then starting from your side. Because you already know us. Let me just start with the honourable member. Starting with me, I'm commonly known as the Inkima. Official name is Ubonu, I'm the chairperson of the committee.
I am Ahmed Manzoor Sheikh Imam. I'm a member of the
committee. Alan McLaughlin, I'm a member of the committee. I'm a member of the
committee.
I'm a monitor with Parliament Monitoring Group, so I'm just taking minutes. Bruce McDougal. McDougal. Sorry, I don't have a speaker.
Judith Ibrahim from the National Treasury, and an observer here today.
I'm Ivan Turok from the Economic Performance and Development Program. Meg Wilson May is the position you offer the best in the education.
Thank you,
sir.
But in the main, we're looking really at education, skills development, and and how it either responds to demand in the labour market, but also with regard to other objectives, national objectives. So today, I will be presenting some evidence on the performance of our basic education and training system, as well as also some evidence arising from the Labour Market Intelligence Partnership Project that looks at more in depth at the post-school education and training system and how that relates to demand in our labour market. Now, I think hopefully these findings will be useful for the committee, I think, to contribute to your deliberations around particular aspects within the relevant budget sections around higher education, specifically, or the post-school education and training system, as well as the basic education section. Okay, so I think the role of education and skills is a given. We all know that that is a basic starting point, and if we do not perform well in terms of our basic education and our skills development in the country, they are, you know, this is a necessary condition for inclusive development and transformation. So as I've explained before, I'll give you a little bit of information around the performance of our basic education system, and then later on in the presentation I will talk to the post-school education and training system. The next slide. So the first, you can go to the next slide. The first figure I'm showing you is drawn, the evidence base there is the trends in international mathematics and science achievements. And we as a country have participated in this in three ways, in 2003, in 2011, and in 2015. And here I'm just showing the trends over time. And the has been seen as very useful because it's the only measure in South Africa which reliably tells us how we have changed internationally benchmarked in terms of our math and our science achievement at school. And I think what is important to highlight from this slide is obviously the improvement of South Africa in terms of all of the participating countries in this international math achievement test. But also I think it is important to caution that out of all of these countries, although we've shown the biggest improvement over time, we are still the lowest performing country among the set of countries that participate in this test. So, you know, there is a bit of a positive story there as well, but we do need to improve the pace of change in the output of our our basic education system. So we need to increase the pace of change, but there is some positive changes over time. Okay, the next slide. I'm not going to go into detail on all of the slides. I mean, the members are welcome to ask me questions, but I just want to highlight and emphasize some key findings across. The next slide here looks at the total performance across the different years that I spoke about earlier in 2003, 2011 and 2015, and it's saying much of the same story. It's showing us that if you look at the top bar, it's showing that we have improved as a country overall in our average math and science scores. And I think another positive aspect coming out of this slide is to show that the biggest improvement has been at the lowest performing quintile. Okay, we can go on to the next slide. Next slide. And then there's a few slides on the difference in mathematics performance by province. I'm not going to go into detail there. It's quite self-explanatory to show that Gauteng is the best performing province in terms of math and science scores, and our Eastern Cape is the lowest performing. So there's differences obviously in terms of provincial performance. The next slide. Also, if we look at change over time, we see that the Western Cape actually hasn't improved over
the time its performance, although it is a well-performing province, but all of the other provinces have shown improvements in maths and science performance at basic education level. You can go on to the next slide. The next slide, please. Again, this is just showing that there's also, in addition to provincial differentiation, there's also differences in mathematics performance, obviously by school type, with our no fee-paying schools performing the poorest and our independent schools performing the best in terms of math performance. Okay, and then the next slide we can go to. You can bring up the little blocks at the bottom. Thank you. I want to highlight these, this slide and the next one, particularly out of everything that I've shown you up until now, because this really, these graphs refer to changes in the home conditions of the learners from 2003 to 2015. And I think it's quite significant that we find in this analysis that learners in households with flush toilets obviously score about 56 points higher on their math score, and learners in households with running water score 54% on average higher, and learners in households where the parents have a grade 12 at least 43 points higher. So this starts to show us the contextual aspects that play a big role in the performance of students in maths and science. And the next slide, you can bring up the little blocks here at the bottom as well. These talk to school provincial context, and this highlights how bullying can play a big role in the maths performance, whether the learners speak the language of the test, have an impact 60 points, and also learners in school with a high emphasis on academic success actually also score much higher. So I think the main point I wanted to make in these two slides is to show the other contextual aspects that actually have a very direct bearing on maths achievement. And I think that's important for the committee when looking at a budget and thinking around whether, you know, infrastructural spending is the best way to go, and I think this gives an evidence base for the actual impact on performance that those kinds of aspects can have. And that would be that's it for the basic education. And then I just quickly want to talk through some of the slides on the higher education, that is the post-school education and training system. And the evidence base that I'm drawing on here is from our Labour Market Intelligence Partnership project, and in the main it analyzed supply in technical vocational education and training skills and higher education and training skills, and then looking also at how the economy has changed and looking at how the demand in the economy then relates to what we are producing currently. The first table is just an OECD table that shows the level of education, level of tertiary education. It's just to give you a sense of where South Africa stands, and you will see we ride down here on the left hand side, although we have improved the proportion of tertiary educated 25 to 64 year olds during the 10 year period between 2000 to 2012, we're very far away from the OECD average. So again, raising the point that we are improving, but we really do need to ramp up the pace of change. The next slide. This is just showing you the enrollments at public universities and civic colleges. Clearly you can see the university sector as bigger than the technical vocation, education and training colleges sector, although there's been much of an expansion of that sector as well over the last few years. The next slide is on the university enrollment and graduation field, and this is just reiterating again that of all of the university enrollment and graduation, we still have a predominance in the humanities. It's still forming the biggest share, so we need to engage with that if we really need to improve our science, engineering and
skill set.
I have a point of clarity. If I understand it correctly, what you are saying there is that you say business economics, are you saying there was 272,000 enrollments and only 50,000 graduated?
Yes, in 2014. Yeah. Okay. And then we can go on to the next slide. And this is giving you the enrollments at civic colleges, also the enrollments and graduations in 2014. And you will see that at technical vocational education and training colleges has the highest enrollments in business. So again here raising the point of whether if we're wanting to transform and improve economic growth, do we need to then ramp up as well our science, engineering and technology qualifications and participation in those kinds of qualifications at civic colleges as well. The next slide starts to look at the economy, and it's showing at universities and civic colleges what kinds of skills are being produced at a different level. And you will see also here if we look at business science, science, engineering, initial teacher education and computer and information business science, the majority of, this is across all of the different types, so universities and civics, the biggest proportion is in business science. That really, okay, so we need to start thinking about whether that might be an oversupply to the economy. And then the last three slides starts to look a little bit closer at these qualifications and where people with these qualifications are working in our economy. And the first slide does that, and it says to us that of the 1.2 million degrees that we have, that is 75% work in the community social services and financial services sector, and the smaller, much smaller proportions in the rest of the economy. And I mean, I think that is very significant because if you take into account that the community and social services that includes the public sector. So the majority of our qualifications are being absorbed by those sectors. And even similarly also for 1.8 million postgraduates, 12 certificates and diplomas, not to the same extent, but also 61% of civic qualifications work across those two sectors in the economy. Okay, and then we can go on to the next, second last slide. And this looks at the types of occupations that these qualifications work in. So in general, we find also there 70% of our degrees work in the managerial and senior official and professional occupational levels. And of the 1.8 million postgraduate 12 certificates and diplomas, we find 16% in managers and senior officials and professionals occupational level. We would have expected that of our postgraduate certificates and diplomas, a bigger proportion would have been employed in the technicians and associate professionals occupational level, but as you will see in the slide, we're not finding that. So that was quite surprising. The last slide, we just looked a little bit closer at the engineering qualifications. And this further points out that engineering is a very versatile skill. Because you can see, what we did also find it interesting that of our engineering qualifications, 31% was in the financial services sector. And also 23% in manufacturing. So this slide is a subset of the previous one because it looks specifically at engineering qualifications. Again, there, you know, we need to think about whether what does this mean for training, and it means that if engineering is such a versatile skill, the implication for our training system is that we need to train many more engineers that are actually needed in engineering jobs. And currently, we're already struggling to fulfill what is demanded in the labor market. call it for now. I mean, any other questions I'd be happy to answer afterwards, and we also have full reports on the Labour Market Intelligence Partnership. We've got a website which I can share with the members afterwards. We've got all of the client reports on there, and then also the TIMS results which I spoke to earlier, which was on the basic education indicators on maths and science. That also has a website, so I can also share that with the members afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you, honourable members. I just said that we will allow each of us to complete and then we engage
with
your members. Expenditure or the amount of money dedicated to the various components. Now the district health service is a very, very important component, and it's actually where health gets delivered, or rather health services get delivered. And if we look at the amount spent there between 15-16, 15-17, and 17-18, I think the significant thing there is to show that there's a kind of a relative growth of around 11%. The mission is to decide whether that's an appropriate amount or if it's growing fast enough. Those are questions for honourable you to talk about. Provincial hospital services, again, that's a lower level service, very, very important. Majority of the population use that service. Again, we see a growth of around 10% there. If we look at other health services, that includes everything else besides hospital services. Again, we're looking at a growth of 11% there. And then if we look at facilities management and maintenance, which I would like to argue is a very, very important component for continued health care, and it's also important in terms of reaching those 30 goals. We're looking at an increase there of around 19%. Also the issue of building new primary health care facilities, new hospitals, all of that falls into that area. So we're looking at an overall spend increase in around of around 11%. And as we know, that time is short, so there's a limited amount on the paper that we can discuss things later. Look at funding priorities, and we look at not just South Africa, but we look at the world. There are certain areas, and we've caught up in the last 20 years, we've caught up with issues that have taken other countries about 60 years to catch up. So if we look at what South Africa wants to achieve, South Africa wants to achieve a life expectancy of around 70 by 2030, which I think is a great expectation, but that also has implications for how we're going to get there, that's one, and two, the meaning of having a large society living 70 years, for example, disease like dementia will increase, and how we put money aside now to deal with what's coming. Having a generation under 20 who's AIDS-free, my colleague will deal with the HIV/AIDS, so I'm not going to talk about it here. If we look at reducing maternal and child mortality, I think given our history, we come with a very dismal history around women and children, and much effort needs to be put into reducing, in particular, child mortality and morbidity as well. I think an area that needs to be seriously considered both for future research, new research, as well as for investment in dealing with current epidemics of disease. We need to look at how we're going to reduce NCDs. So to deviate a little bit here, and I want to say that for the area of NCDs, South Africa has very good legislation around tobacco control and tobacco prevention, but we are rolling back because our initiatives for prevention would appear to have diminished. And that's what the data is demonstrating. Or we can, as researchers, we can just talk about what the data is telling us and what we think or learn from all of us as to how to move forward. So I urge that there's more expenditure in control of tobacco and to look at tobacco legislation. In addition, there's more pieces of legislation or amendments of the legislation, like the plain packaging, that haven't been put into place here. And on Saturday we saw the UK was actually being behind us in tobacco control, put in plain packaging, and they've done away with selling packs of 10, which is you can only buy packs of 20. We also need to look at the issue of the slow taxation and us not meeting our taxation goals with regards to tobacco. And then implementing the NHI policy, which you all know, I'm sure, very well about, very well. We're looking at that happening over the next 14 years. It's not 14, now it's 12, I think. So in terms of implementing NHI policy translation, we would require major investments, and the investments are not just those investments that I spoke about in-house facilities, the broader comprehensive capacity and other areas of health. Preparatory work is currently being done, it needs to be accelerated, we need to examine where that preparatory work is taking us. I also think that because we're kind of starting a new project there, well, it's not new, as I said, it's 2 years old in terms of implementation, we need to engage actively in research and monitoring so we can track our successes, so we can track where we need to implement changes, where we need to improve things. So that has a major research component. There's been much talk about creation of the NHI fund, starting with 20 billion around tax credits, and moving into around 26 billion with regard to medical subsidies. Again, there's much space for innovation in this area, but the innovation can only come if we do research and learn from how we're doing it, what's working, what's not working, rather than best guesses. We need to look at the various types of models that people are talking about. And I think one needs people out of the medical sector to also look at these issues and try and understand these issues. And providing hospital management and greater decision-making powers around current preparations that are happening. We need to look at how, you know, the business sector deals with this. We need to look at, I mentioned this earlier, but really significant investment in capacity development. And when I mean capacity development, we're talking about investments in doctors and nurses, community caregivers, and other health professionals as well. Also, we know that we've got each province has one pilot district, but KwaZulu-Natal has two pilot districts. We need to look at how this is going to expand. We need to really bring to the front the lessons that might be learned from those pilot districts. And finally, as we know, the country had engaged for a long time with the training of doctors in Cuba. Many, many of those young people are returning to the various provinces. We need to look at how we're going to absorb them, and what maximum impact they can make and how they can be deployed, because that project brings with it some very strong skills in primary health care. There's one more slide. We also think that there should be a lot of more investment in maternal and child health, and we need to look at how we're going to reduce the current high mortality rates and how we meet the SDG goals. I spoke about non-communicable diseases from a prevention perspective, but there's the treatment perspective, there's the rehabilitation perspective, and we need to look at enhancing human resources and capacity in this area of work. We also need to look at various types of models of service delivery, and I think service delivery and intervention services as well, before patients get the actual illness, and how we deal with that. Then we look at, we need to look at how perhaps we're going to benefit from various technologies that can improve patient care, that can improve delivery of health. I know us at the SSRC, we're looking at using mobile technology to get to adolescent girls who are pregnant to improve their treatment outcomes or their baby outcomes. And a very, very important area, we need to look at building capacity in this whole area of governance and stewardship around the healthcare system, both the public healthcare system and the private healthcare system. We need to look at how we're going to bring these together over the next 14 years if we are. And then I mentioned this repeatedly in all of the areas, we really need to do evaluation, tracking and monitoring to look at how we improve the systems that we hope to let in place, and lessons that we can learn from, things that might not have gone so well.
Okay, good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I will continue discussing on health issues, but focusing more on HIV, AIDS, and TB. Just to give a context, during the past year, three things have happened. Firstly, the department adopted what is called the 1990 program, which is based on one which was developed by the United Nations on a global level. Basically, these numbers signify that by 2020, we want 90% of all people living with HIV in our country to know their status. That's the first 90. The second one is that of all those people who are diagnosed as having HIV, 90% of them should receive treatment. And thirdly, and equally important, is that 90% of those who are receiving treatment should be what we call virally suppressed. It means the medicine must be taken rigidly so that they actually work, and therefore reduce the viral loss. So that's one contextual issue. The second one is sometime in September, last year, the Department of Health also implemented what is called the Universal Test and Treat Policy. This is a simple and straightforward idea that as soon as you are tested to be HIV and found to be HIV positive, you start treatment. Members, you recall in the past, people had to get to a certain criterion of 250 to be able to qualify for treatment. This was increased to 350 and the previous year to 500. The amount saying it doesn't matter. What's important is you are found to be HIV positive, you get on treatment immediately. The rationale behind that is that the sooner you start with treatment, the better are your chances to actually live a long and happy life. And thirdly, a couple of months ago, SANAC launched the new National Strategic Plan for HIV, TB, and sexually transmitted infections for the next 5 years. This is a blueprint which the government and civil society and funders used to plan our national response. And basically we set in there our target in terms of what we want to achieve over the next 5 years. The new NSP covers the years from this year, 2017, until 2022. Clearly, if we are to reach those targets, It means that we have our work cut out for us, which is why we will need to match that with the resources. Just a glance, and it's not in the slide yet, at a glance, the budget allocation is meant to increase from 16 billion from the previous financial year up to 22.9 billion in 2019-20, which is an average annual rate of 12.8% over the medium term. However, to get closer, when you actually look closely at it, unfortunately, there have been no increase, for example, for the comprehensive HIV, AIDS, and TB grant, which provides for antiretroviral treatment. Although we are supposed to increase the number of people who are on treatment from 4.3 million to 4.5 million. Secondly, just looking closely at the budget allocation, even procurement of condoms, that actually will be locked down. There will be a reduction in the allocation of 78 million. In terms of treatment, actually there is a reduction of 102.4 million. According to the documents. So it seems on the one hand we are setting these higher goals that we want to achieve, but perhaps the allocations are not quite matching what we wish to do. I will go through the slides just briefly, just to remind ourselves of the two. In fact, there are twin epidemics of HIV and TB in our country. So, as we all know by now, South Africa has the largest number of people living with HIV/AIDS in the world, estimated at 7.1 million. This is out of a total of 36 million across the world. Perhaps not to share, you know, that negative doom. For example, the bad news is the prevalence among the elderly is still increasing, and there are reasons for that. Partly, the success of the treatment that we are giving means people are living longer. So there is a bit of positive news. Not everybody is dying. Unfortunately, there are still new infections happening. The real good news is what's happening among the young people, where there have been significant declines in HIV, particularly amongst those aged 15 to 24. As members might have been informed last year, we are currently undertaking two surveys in the HSRC. The one is the 27 National Population-Based HIV Survey. These are surveys we do every 3 to 4 years to estimate the number of people living with HIV. We can also estimate the number of people who have been affected during the past year using laboratory tests. And we can therefore be able to focus on the different age groups, and we can describe this at national level and provincial level. And interestingly, for the first time, we might also be able to do that at a few district levels. Unfortunately, only 16 districts, because we are collecting information from 60,000 people. We are also conducting, for the first time, the first ever national TB survey together with the Medical Research Council and Statistics SA. For some reason, We are among the few countries that have never had this national TB survey. For both surveys, for the HIV one, we might have the results by the end of this year, but for the TB survey, we will have the results next year. Moving on to the next slide, just as one can say that we have the amongst the worst HIV data from our country, unfortunately the picture about TB is not much better. We are among the top six countries when it comes to new TB infections, so that basically the scenario is really very bad. But what is important perhaps from this slide, if you look in the third row, the numbers have been of new cases which are diagnosed have been decreased. It means that at least something is going well there, but we still have amongst the highest rates of TB infection in the world. Next slide. Okay, carry on. All right. This slide you have to look from the bottom up in order to match it with the years from 2008 to 12. Basically, again, it shows a positive picture that the percentage of all deaths are decreasing from 12.6 in 2008 to 8.4 in 2012. If you see the trend, in that last column there is that drop if you're going upwards from the bottom. So sorry, it should have been the other way. So there is some progress being made even in the case of TB. Next slide. That's what I said. Next slide. Okay. Of course, one of the success stories, given the magnitude of our epidemic in the country, is that our government has also responded in kind. In terms, compared to other countries on the continent, South Africa is one of the few countries that allocate a very large proportion of the fiscals to support their national response to HIV. So in fact, you can see the trend there from way back in 2006 and 7 to now, we are at 17 to 18 to 19 billion is estimated to be the amount that will be allocated, as I said earlier, by in 3 years' time, by the end of this MTF. Some of the funds that are provided, perhaps not enough, do go to NGOs. And South Africa is renowned for having some of the most really NGOs that are really the best in what they do. It is because of the experiences that have been gained, for example, Love Life and Soul City, amongst NGOs that are renowned worldwide for the excellent work they do, the kind of initiatives that they lead. A bit of a concern is perhaps on the budget that's allocated to the National AIDS Council, which is supposed to oversee the whole response. Last year, there was an allocation of just over 16 million. It has increased slightly to 17 million. But in addition to that, they are also allocated an amount for this last year it was for this year it's going to be 15 million rand more. This is for intervention, together, working together with the National Department of Health. This is meant to increase next year to 30 million and the following year to 32 million rand. Again, given the scope of our epidemic, one would have hoped that there is a bigger allocation, particularly if we want to make sure that by 2030 we begin to see our desire to help an age-free young generation in the country. All right, next slide, and this is the last slide. So, indeed, there are several allocations which are given by the fiscus, not only to SANAC and the National Department of Health. We wish to acknowledge that we also allocate funding to, among others, Department of Social Development. There is also a Department of Higher Education and Training. And also even the Department of Science and Technology. An omission on my part there is the Department of Basic Education as well. It does get an allocation for basic, the life skills education, which focuses on HIV/AIDS. There has just been a slight increase in the allocation this year compared to last year. I think I will end there. Thank you. Thank you very much.
What you like, Mr. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the economy, themes around inclusive growth in particular, and what that means, and whether it is sustainable. So just by way of context, a slide about the context, the economic slowdown we're all familiar with, it is clearly a major concern when it comes to raising the taxes required to pay for increased health spending and education spending and other forms of welfare and redistribution. Government debt has been rising fast over the last 8 years, from 24% to 51% of GDP. There's a large budget deficit, gap between spending and revenue, 3.4% of GDP. As a result, debt servicing costs have been rising at roughly 10% per annum since 2009. So this helps to explain the sense of austerity that is emerging within the public finances. Poor investment climate, weak business and consumer confidence, a great deal of concern about the situation facing the economy. A little elbow room to raise the funding required for the kinds of things that my colleagues have been talking about so far. So, next slide, please. The overall assessment of the budget and of the resulting appropriations bill, a shift in approach very much over the last 7 or 8 years from counter-cyclical spending to try and counter the effect of the global recession and the downturn, to now an agenda of modest tax increases and a slowdown in public spending. Tax increases in the budget consisted of personal income, a higher spread of personal income tax for people with high incomes, a new 45% threshold, increased levy on share dividends, and the fuel levy going up by 30% per litre, an increase in the road accident levy. These were just some of the headline tax increases that have happened this year. The other side of it is the slowdown in the growth in public spending. So we're not actually experiencing cuts, it's the slower growth, 2% reduction in budgeted spending over the next three years, 28 billion. And a freeze on the public sector headcount, so no net increase in staffing across government. And then the other element that's emerging very strongly is a tougher approach to managing state entities to try and keep the ballooning deficits of some of the entities under control. So next slide, please. So I'm going to spend really just the next 5 minutes. My key theme is around inclusive growth. This is crucial, of course, because of the continuing inequalities in the country, economic inequalities, social inequalities, and the spatial divides that exist between rich, affluent areas and poor areas, rural areas, townships in our country. So how do we address this? I think we really, key message, we need to move beyond slogans and rhetoric to actually getting more specific about what the challenge is and how we address it. So to define inclusive growth, I start with the two key aspects to it. So firstly, it's not just an outcome. Most of the time when we talk about inclusive growth, we talk about the outcome of fairness and sharing and equity, right? Sharing the benefits of growth, implying that the way to achieve inclusion is redistribution. We take money from the rich and we give it to the poor in different forms, through social grants, through free housing, through free basic services, through free healthcare and so on. I think what we're experiencing now through the slowdown is that there are limits to this approach to inclusive growth. And there are questions being raised about whether it addresses the root causes of poverty and inequality. If we simply redistribute from one to another, we're not growing the size of the cake, we are just shuffling the cards. Okay, now that's just, I don't want to, that's keep putting it too negatively, that's very important because of where we come from. But we also need to think more creatively about inclusive growth. So it's the second key part is that it's a process. It's not just an outcome. It's about involving people, participation in contributing to the expansion of the economy. A more dynamic approach to tackling poverty than simply putting more money into people's pockets. Right? It's actually helping them to become more self-sustaining, so that they themselves have the capabilities and the wherewithal, the assets, to increase their income and their wealth and their well-being over time. That's critically important. We don't talk enough about that process of participation in the economic agenda in order to ensure that this is self-sustaining and so on. So it means employment, it means enterprise, it means skills and capabilities, it means assets, housing, pensions, savings, where we are not doing well at all in terms of the redistribution and access to savings and pensions, which is critical. So just go back a second, please, Noor. The last point, we have to think about progression. We have to think about mobility, ladders out of poverty, roots out of poverty, okay? So not just this approach of welfare, but actually thinking about it as a process of change over time for real transformation. That's what transformation really is, but we don't hear enough talk about that. It's a change over time, a progressive thing. So if we look at the spatial dimension, which I want to particularly emphasize, because when we talk about inclusive growth, we don't talk enough about spatial inequality. Look at, of course the inheritance is really bad. No, we're not coordinating well. Next slide, please. Okay, I'm going to give you a signal. So of course, apartheid, that was critical to apartheid, the separation of people, right? So the legacy of spatial inequality is profound in South Africa, and it's something we have to take more seriously. What's happened since 94, and you can see this shows the GDP per province across the country, okay? We've seen a further widening of divisions. So the relatively urbanized provinces, Gauteng, Western Cape, KZN, have done relatively well. The relatively rural provinces have struggled to take up the slack, have struggled to perform well. So we've seen a widening of spatial gaps in terms of provinces and regions, okay? A widening of the gap. And you can see a lot of continuity in that pattern. There's not been much movement. We're stuck on a path dependent trajectory, which we've not done anything about really. There's been a blip in 2009 with the recession, but since then we've seen further widening. So, you know, we've not been effective at tackling at the regional scale the spatial divide. Let's look at what's happened to taxes and the consequence of this for taxation. Okay, so we don't say much about that, but basically the golden goose of South Africa is Gauteng. Nearly half of all tax revenues are generated in Gauteng. Okay, that's the top set of figures showing where the taxes are generated in the country. We don't have sufficient understanding of that. This is the golden goose. This is critical to the financial sustainability of the country. Right? We can discuss precisely what one does about that, but this is a fact of life that is not widely understood. The second row of circles shows per capita how much tax is generated, right? So for each person living in each of the provinces along the bottom, it shows that actually people living in Gauteng pay more taxes than people living in every other province. It's not just that it's a bigger and wealthier province, it's actually that people are more productive, putting it simply, in Gauteng than they are anywhere else. And you can imagine the sequence of places, Eastern Cape, Northwest, Limpopo, are relatively less productive than the places on the left. In other words, they are not generating the level of taxes. So we don't have much understanding of that. Why is Gauteng and the Western Cape more productive, generating far more tax per person? The disparities are quite wide. Why is that? Really, we haven't got good answers to that question. Okay, so then this slide is published, these figures were published in the Budget Review a couple of months ago, which is really interesting. It's the first time this data has been made available by the Treasury. It shows how the tax I've just talked about, how it's allocated between provinces across the bottom and between municipalities across the top. And the disparities are, again, very, very striking. Basically, there's massive redistribution going on from Gauteng, in particular, to the rest of the country, right? So the metros in Gauteng are basically shifting, generating this wealth, and then that resource is being redistributed to the poorer municipalities and to the poorer provinces. And the scale of the redistribution is very striking, right? So that the rural municipalities receive more than twice as much spending, more than twice as much revenue from government as the metros, more than twice as much per head of population. That's a very, very big extent of redistribution. Now, it's really important that, because these rural municipalities are much poorer, and of course, going back 20 years, there was the backlogs of services are much greater in the rural areas, but there are big questions about going forward. How do we sustain this in the context of a slow economy? Are we actually creating the conditions in the poorer provinces and the poorer municipalities to ensure that in the future they will start generating tax as well? Or are we simply compensating? Are we simply shifting from rich to poor areas in a way that's undermining the golden goose, and that is not sustainable, putting it bluntly? Right, so that's a key question raised by these slides. Are we creating conditions for development in the poorer parts of the country? Development that will be self-sustaining and that will start generating taxes. That's the big $1,000 million question that we're not talking about when we talk about inclusive growth and development. And my last diagram is this, just vividly illustrate the extent of the transfer that's taking place. So the metros generate 70% of personal income tax revenue, and they receive only 31%. That all goes into a pot, you can imagine. That 70% of the pot comes from the metros. They then get back in return 31% of the pot, a third of the pot. They put in two-thirds of the pot, they get a third back. The rural municipalities put in 5%. They put a small amount into the pot and they get a third back from the pot out of this transfer, right? So they're doing really well from the net shift in resources. The metros are losing out big time. And as I say, that's healthy because of where we've come from and because of the extent of poverty in the poorer areas, but is it sustainable? And my last slide says we need, okay, what are we talking about? We're talking about development, we're talking about self-sustaining growth, we're talking about real inclusive growth. We have to go beyond the slogans and get specific. So these are three key elements of what a strategy for inclusive growth should consist of. Right, so if we're serious about radical socioeconomic transformation, what are the elements that would be part of that? And here are three of them. First one is the labor market. We have to look more systematically at the labor market. We have to understand the causes of exclusion. Why are some people, some communities excluded from jobs? Right? We've got to address those issues. Some of it is to do with demand. There's not enough. Employers are not creating enough jobs. Some of it is to do with skills and education. We heard about that. Some of it is to do with discrimination. We need to understand that better. And then we need to have solutions to these problems, right? So we need to be systematic, is what I'm saying, about addressing exclusion and then ensuring that our strategies for inclusive growth respond to the causes of exclusion. We need more growth. We need better education and training systems in our poorer areas, our poorer communities. And we need to enforce laws against discrimination to address that particular problem. So the labor market is critical to inclusive growth. The second theme is the land market and the way the housing system operates, because people have to get closer to where the jobs are. Right? So we need to think about the cost of well-located land. We need to think about how our planning system works to exclude poorer communities. We need to think about building regulations and how they also discriminate against lower income households. And then the responses to that, using public land. Why don't we use public land, the Transnet, the public works, the defense, that they hold for well-located housing? It's a no-brainer. We'd be so slow to make progress on this agenda. Better regulations, transport connections, that's a better integrated transport system to give people living in the townships and informal settlements better access to opportunities. And then the third element, I said, just these are just illustrative, is around enterprise. Basically, we don't give adults social grants, right? Redistribution happens with children and pensioners and disabled. We don't redistribute to adults. What we should be doing is doing our level best to enable them to create enterprises, right? Small enterprises. Instead, often we get in the way, we evict informal traders. We are very tough on people trying to create livelihoods for themselves. And we just, a newspaper was out in Pretoria, there's a drive now by the municipality to evict informal traders. You know, we've been there before, we continue to come back to this punitive approach to people. All they're trying to do is generate a livelihood for themselves. We don't give them grants. What we should be doing is supporting them and creating the conditions to enable them to, you know, operate enterprises in a way that's hygienic, in a way that's not going to create congestion on the pavements, etc. But there's a positive approach rather than a punitive approach. Support competition policy, relaxing some of our punitive bylaws in order to enable enterprise. So that's the end of my story on the economy. My colleague who had prepared the slide on land reform, the slide on land reform, has not been able to be with us. I'm just going to spend a minute on land reform. Basically, we've produced a policy brief looking at whether the land reform program is working, and the message is that it's a very mixed bag, a very mixed success. Some farms performing reasonably well, many farms not performing very well. The obstacles to progress are around the knowledge that people who are being redistributed farms, their knowledge of farming, their access to finance, their access to energy, funnily enough, are all constraints on redistributed farms doing well. So the message that's emerging from this work is that actually the process of rural transformation needs to go beyond just farming and land redistribution. It needs to be a more comprehensive approach to rural development, is the key message. Let me move on quickly to the state-owned enterprises also. That's the last few slides that I want to just mention. Again, the colleague who was involved in preparing this. Oh, you're here. Sorry, John. Yes, yes.
Thanks, I have a lot in my voice. So this is the last part of the presentation. I know it's been a bit long, so I'll genuinely keep it brief. One of the things that Dr. Turok mentioned was that we need to take a tougher approach to managing SOEs. And that's one of the things that I'll emphasize here. In terms of appropriations, there's three sections. The one is administrative support and services. The next one is legal and governance services. And the third one is portfolio management and strategy and partnership. Now, what I've noticed is that the most money is afforded to administrative support services, whereas, as you will see from my presentation, the real problem lies with legal and governance services. So just quickly, we're a research council, so we're obviously looking at the whole issue of research and development and the competitiveness of state-owned enterprises. There was a report released by the Presidential Review Committee led by Rio Piega in 2013. The Human Sciences Research Council was involved in this research together with the committee. And there were obviously some issues that needed to be addressed there. There was an emphasis on the fact that there needed to be opportunities to allow governments to influence service delivery of SOEs. And that wide acceptance that SOEs need to perform these services while maintaining operational efficiency and international competitiveness. So it's a balance between the two. That there seems to be either balance on one side or the other. Then innovative and efficient SOEs, they play a vital role in our economy. Four of the largest SOEs, Eskom, Transnet, Brunel, and Telkom, account for 91% of the assets, 86% of turnover, 77% of SOE employment. And they are key to national industrialization. We want to take that seriously in terms of our development policy. It's important that R&D is conducted within the SOE sector for the sake of development. And the top 10 SOEs, as I think you can all guess who they are responsible for 99% of research and development performed. However, there has been underspending in some of the largest SOEs. SOEs are not reporting on research and development expenditure levels in the stakeholder compact. And also some SOEs that should be performing research and development on. So that is a problem that is being faced. And then again, the PRC report has stated that efficiency, growth, innovation, competitiveness should be put high on the agenda. There should be support for current research and development projects taking place to investigate the extent and nature of the research and development performed, and then perhaps to look at levels of spending. Now, a couple of interesting things came out of PRC, and I think that some of it hasn't been implemented, although the report was released in 2013. So, South Africa has made strides and efforts to reform this landscape, but the environment is still raw, especially in governance, oversight, job creation, and services. Despite attempts to harmonize with the SOE landscape, it's not clear how many exist in South Africa. Now, they're called state-owned enterprises, state-owned entities, some of them public entities, and you know you have your three schedules in the PFMA, 1, 2, and 3A to C. When the HSRC we started the research, we were informed that there were approximately 300 state-owned entities in the South African landscape. After the census, that took a number of months because we had to follow research, it was established that there are 716 state-owned entities in South Africa, and obviously a recommendation was made to cut that down. It is difficult to monitor and measure success because of the fact that there are so many SOEs and there is no certainty around them, and therefore the way in which they fulfill the developmental agendas of the state, there's a question there as well. So there are terminological contradictions and confusions prevailing, as I've already mentioned, and a lot of this hasn't been addressed yet. State-owned enterprises operate within a framework of multiple pieces of legislation, which are at times in conflict with the broad strategic development thrust of the state as reflected in NDP Region 2030. So, as we know, the SOEs are supposed to support the state in its developmental agenda. A critical issue raised in the Presidential Review Committee exercise study was whether the legal instruments should have some form of universal application, an umbrella legislation, or whether South Africa should retain sector-based reductionist arrangements to formulate legislation aimed at specific state-owned entities. So there's still legal confusion around the role of state-owned entities and the classification, let's call it that, of state-owned entities. So we need to look at how to deal with conflicting terminologies and laws that exist. Governance reforms. This is why I say we need to focus on legal and governance. More resources are needed to strengthen governance, shareholder oversight, and accountability instruments from the SOEs. Very few of the SOEs actually have the same governance body. So you have a situation where there are some SOEs that operate on boards, for example. More often than not, there are acrimonious relationships amongst the shareholders and the board, and this is illustrated by a number of reports that have been released by the former public protector. So if not attended to, the socioeconomic impact of these SOEs would be at risk. So we suggest a regular review of state-owned entities that both the scope and the depth, you know, the broadness and the depth of it, that we have a monitoring and evaluation mechanism by tracking implementation of the 31 short and long-term recommendations of the CRC. So there were 31 recommendations released by the Presidential Review Committee, and you know, this went through the cabinet process as far as we are aware. But it is important to ensure that these are monitored and evaluated to see which of these recommendations have been implemented, which haven't, which have worked, and which haven't. So the monitoring and evaluation of the SOE should then continue to ensure that we have control over the landscape so it can be properly managed and monitored. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ken. We're happy to take any questions.
Honourable members, we have been listening to this meeting by Women Science Research Council. I'd like you to reflect on it and then we can tell us. Honourable member Imam, who else is it? Honourable member Chimpanyan.
Thank you, Chair, and allow me to thank each different aspect of the report. Very knowledgeable, and thank you for that. At the same time, I must tell you, I'm leaving here very depressed after what I have just seen. Realistically, we do a lot, we try to do a lot, show there's so much more to do that we have to do. But I'm just going to leave you with one question because I need to run away.
My concern is just on the issue of the HIV in terms of the status. I don't know if you can tell us what percentage of HIV increase in HIV infections per year at the moment. So let me tell you where I'm coming from. The population increase in South Africa, in my understanding, is about 1.6 to 1.7% per year. We're talking about, whilst we talk about a reduction in the younger, the 15 to 24, my concern is that just along the 15 to 24, there's 2,000 new infections per year. Now that is very frightening if you look at the percentage of new infections. Just see that, we're cutting down to the bone. Compare it to the population increase, if I am correctly, in what I'm thinking, the whole of South Africa will be wiped out of country. If you look at the new infections per year, in terms of the growth rate of what is going on, we're running the risk of having a very, very serious problem. Whilst we're doing a lot and spending a lot of money, I don't know, maybe you at some stage look into that and maybe you can get it in writing or like comments. So that is really what I want to say. And the second thing is that I see you emphasize on something very, very important, which is what we as this committee have also been tackling, is the issue of the children's colleges and universities. It's really out of touch, out of line. You've brought producing something, you know, on one hand, in the meantime, the needs of the country is completely something else. But I don't know if at some stage you can give us some stats on what exactly percentage, and I'm going to break it down a little bit, how many people graduated in a particular field but are now performing other menial jobs, you understand? I want to see that because then it's going to clearly make people understand that where we are going is clearly, clearly not in the environment. So if you can just give us that, I think it will actually help. And finally, I'm confused about one thing. Because, yes, I know we're not producing enough engineers, but at the same time, there is a great need for engineers, yet we're finding engineers that doing other work as well. So I don't understand it. But unfortunately, I have to leave. But I'm sure I'll get it from my colleagues
or perhaps from my colleagues.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you very much for this presentation. And I will stop now. I think I've ended up, you know, some of the things you take for granted just to have an understanding, but when a study like this is presented, it's very, very helpful. The first thing that I just would like to speak to is the issue of children's colleges. It's a matter of serious concern that children's colleges or qualifications which are equivalent to matric, no wonder these people are often unemployable, just like matriculants. And I know I've heard that the quality of training at the college is very much wanting, but this shows a very big picture. And it obviously, as it seems, and I'm hoping that from 2014, because it was in 2014, maybe something would have been done to try and really bring about a change, because as we think, they are not serving the purpose for which they were established. And this goes for what my colleagues have also, not goes for that, but I want to also link it to the issue of engineers, which my colleague has mentioned that every day we have this song of saying, you know, we must train more engineers, engineers is a demand. But then if we are training them for something else, really, I was just looking at the issue of mining and quarrying. I may not be profound in those things, but those are the areas that you would expect that engineers would go and work. But as things stand, this mismatch is obviously one of the biggest contributors to our problems that we are experiencing. And the issue of the budget. And the inadequate resources. I think it's one area where everybody is really crying out that we are underfunded. One can say also that health is one of the of of the program that is allocated. The second largest budget was to have, but I suppose within health that is where we will need to look. But everyone comes and says we are underfunded, and it's a catch 20 situation where you don't know where to take. And I'm glad that this also is accompanied by this presentation on the economy, because then everyone is told to tighten your belt. These cuts are across the board. And obviously we do need to look at how we allocate the budget and find those areas. Of course, there are already issues like compensation of employees and all that. But programs like this, like for instance in the area of enterprises, already a huge budget is going there, but the demand is just so huge that I don't know what to say, but we just to acknowledge the fact that really this is one area. And in terms of NGO funding, you know, we've got all these NGOs doing a lot of work. But there is also the element of saying, I'm not counting the solar cities and all of those are NGOs that are really developing. But there are those many little NGOs that spend most of the money on salaries for themselves instead of service delivery. I do not have a study or anything, but it's been common knowledge that a lot of them are using money for their salaries rather than the extra service delivery. There's quite a number of things that I will try and not really go on and on. The issue of non-communicable diseases, I don't know what we're ever going to do with it. Because our lifestyles are just something else, because many of them are related to our lifestyles. The issues of prevention, I know you mentioned the issue of prevention, of prevention of this and wellness programs. Are our wellness programs really working in South Africa? I think I will stop and maybe I'll come back to give another chance. Thank you very much.
So I want to raise one of the issues that fortunately is this the time to implement component that's been inside, and then you raise the issue of change in all provincial context, where we are indicating that access to flush toilets, running water, is relevant on those things. I guess that in the household, somebody who's having a matrix education maybe can contribute, but if it's toilet and water, maybe people can clarify. The other issue is about to civic rights. They've mentioned that we're among the top 50 countries with high. The last one is with regards to the inter-regional redistribution, the sex-to-sex. We talk about housing and Western Cape, but I found it a very good slide, the Northern Cape and Eastern Cape. People can get services from the Northern Cape.
The presentation, but what concerns me is that a lot of the information seems to be outdated. We've got information from 2012, we've got information regarding TB prevalence when we were a kid, we've got information about TB death during child now. I mean, it's 5 years or 4 years since then. So it would be
Thank you.
DAF 96.6 million postal education. The observation of also flowing from your presentation, the graduation rates are low, and also another challenge that the selected courses are not the ones that are needed in the economy. So how would you recommend, what would be your recommendation as a collective measure?
Thank you for those
comment honourable member. You're quite right, some of the data is outdated. Indeed, if you look even in the National Strategic Plan, because there hasn't been a survey, particularly in the HIV, they're waiting for the results of what we are doing now. Going forward, the results will be updated. I'm sure we could have updated them by a couple of years, but it's never up to date. And they are estimates, but if we want actual information, it's only be available next year. But your point is well taken.
Okay, I'm going to deal first with the points or comments raised in relation to the basic education, and then I'll deal with the social education and training system qualifications and links to the labour market. The question around the slide, talking to changing from home provincial context, talking about access to flush toilets, access to running tap water, and household education about matric. You know, what is quite different in the South African study and what all of the international partners are actually now including in their studies, looking at science and maths achievement, is that we are including this home context. We're looking at other things that impact on test scores. So yes, we measure the average scores and we look at how it's improving over in the country and how it's differentiated by province and various other aspects, but we also realize that there are other contextual aspects that play a role in people's achievement. It's got absolutely nothing to do with the intellectual ability. And that is part of the reason why we're including home context variables. I mean, another one of the home context variables was access to reading material at home. That also has a significant impact on people's math achievements and science achievement scores. And so that's the only reason why we included that. And I think it is important because there might be a perception that, you know, some of the students have intellectual problems, but it's not necessarily that is the case. I think it's an important, it's an indictment of the system that we cannot overcome many of these contextual issues at home. And education is supposed to help us overcome these structural inequalities. But that is the reason I shared that. Okay, so that's the first for education and training, but I'm happy to talk further if you would like to go into more detail. Then the question on the civic qualification being at NCF level 4, which is equivalent to a matric. What we find in our participation in the post-school education and training system is the zigzag progression or pathways that people tend to participate in qualifications that they already qualifications at the level of which they already have. I think it is people trying, if they do not find work, they then return to either a learnership or an apprenticeship. Doesn't matter if it's at the same entry qualification, but just to do something that is that seems to be worthwhile. And we do find that many people that do participate in an apprenticeship and a learnership or skills program do transition into the labour market afterwards. But it is problematic that we have this zigzag progression pathways through our PSET system. It is pointing to inefficiencies in the system. There are some legislative issues with regards to this NQF level 4 the predominance of participation at NQF level 4 at civic colleges, because civic colleges can offer NQF level 5 but only in conjunction with the university. And so this has been raised as a legislative issue that might be blocking a lot of people's articulation and progression through the system because it's limiting their options. So that, I'm not sure whether that is an issue that can be addressed through a resourcing or a financing issue. That might actually be a legislative issue that needs to be unblocked. Okay. And showed in the last issue was sort of broadly around the mismatch between qualifications and uptake in the labour market. Now this is a very difficult one. It's a very, demand is a very fickle thing and it's very contested. So it's very difficult because you're looking at the labour market and you're looking at current employment and that's a derived demand. So you're looking at where employers are taking people in and you're taking that as an indication of demand for those kind of qualifications or people with particular kinds of skills. But that might be outdated because we might have labour market data that's on 2013, but it's actually reflecting demand that was earlier on. You know, so just to give that kind of background. And also the employment, the nature of employment is also a function of the opportunities that are available in the labour market. Now, Professor Turok spoke about the constrained economic environment that we're in, so that also predicts where people are sometimes taken up that might not be in line with their qualifications. So, what I'm trying to say in a roundabout way, I can't really answer that question very well because demand is not so easy to clarify, but I do think that the members have picked up correctly that this is pointing to an inefficiency in the post-school education and training system, that if we need more engineers, we obviously should be getting more people in engineering jobs. So it's very difficult because people also make choices. You cannot limit a person if they've trained as an engineer. You can't say that they can't choose to work in a different sector with better employment opportunities or better remuneration. So that is the difficulty that we do struggle with in aligning supply and demand. I don't know if I can answer that one better, but I'm happy to debate with anyone on it afterwards. And then in closing, I just want to say that I think I would take all of these questions as speaking to our trying to share findings to show the labour market impact of spending on post-school education and training. And I think in terms of that, we do lack the kind of research that will help us answer these questions better. So there's been a lot of motivation around institutionalizing tracer study kind of research to get a better handle on the labour market impact, because currently we do not have a nationally coherent system that can show us the return on investment to different kinds of qualifications. So the Department of Higher Education and Training is currently working on that. And then I just want to make one point around the proportion of spending with regards to the appropriations. Well, I just looked at the basic education and the higher education and training. So I don't want to comment really about what is correct and incorrect because that would be outside of the scope of research and not, and I wouldn't want to come outside of an evidence base. But the only comment that I would have around that is that if I look at the proportion of spending allocated to the technical vocational education and training system as opposed to the higher education system, which has got 80% of the spending allocated within the higher education and training budget, I don't think that's in line with the intentions of the white paper on post-school education and training that is trying to expand the technical vocational education and training system. So the technical vocational education and training system is, at this point, we need to improve its efficiency, but it is critical in expanding and getting those marginalized, those that are out, which is the majority of our labor force, don't even have a matric. So we do need to expand access to technical vocational education and training at that level and not necessarily at university level, because we need to include more people and like I said, the majority of our labor force don't have a matric either. So yeah, sorry, I can go on forever. Yeah.
Like with you, so I want to take the health question.
Thanks, Chair, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. The first question caused by the imam, as I guess. I think we need to contextualize the discussion on HIV prevalence. We need to make a distinction between all cases, prevalence means all cases of HIV. We don't even know when some of them were acquired. Somebody could have been living with HIV for the past 30 years, for example. But what is really key is what we call HIV incidence, which simply means new infection, in particular those acquired in the past 1 year. I think if we look at prevalence overall, we will miss the picture. Really what is important is to monitor incidence, which is part of what we are doing in this survey, so that we really can tell a story about overall what's happening. I think compared to where we were maybe 10 years ago, the story is really a positive one, that overall the incidence is coming down. The new infections are dropping, and particularly among young people. So compared to where we were 10 years ago, even if it's 2,000, that's the latest estimate we have of new infections among young people per week, that's even less than half from compared to where we start. So the important thing is we must continue with that downward trajectory if eventually we are going to get over the disease. So the new infections peaked a while ago, and from the data that we have been collecting, it seems that we are consistently dropping. But you have to remember now we have thrown into the picture these highly effective drugs, in particular the latest drugs that are available, treatment. It's even more effective, so that fewer and fewer people are dying from HIV. It simply means whatever number we have had, there are people who are not dying. But unfortunately, we are still having a few more still being infected. And that's why the number keeps going up a little bit. So we have to factor those two issues together. I acknowledge, and I might have overstepped my comments there to say there has been a cut. Honestly, these are acknowledged in the bill, that there have been cuts, for example, in the amount of money being allocated towards treatment. There is a figure presented in the bill. Similarly, the amount of money being allocated for buying of condoms. That's true, there is a specific amount indicated which I alluded to. So it runs counter to our wish to see more people on treatment, right? As well as actually prevention is best. Those condoms are needed. But let me balance that by saying we do rely a lot on some external donors who have been funding our response to HIV AIDS in a generous manner. For example, there is PEPFAR, which is funded by the American government, and also now there is a global fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria. These organizations are giving fairly reasonable amounts of money to the response. If we add to what we get to the system, we are able to continue doing a lot of things. In Kenya, however, particularly with the American source of funding, should they cut that down? All of a sudden, it means that all the funding that has been available for dealing with other aspects other than shipping, those are going to suffer. Right? And really, that's my point there. Which countries have high incidence of TB? Interestingly, for some reason, it includes other BRICS countries like Russia, China, and India, as well as a few neighboring countries which I won't mention. So if we're to get the top six, they do include Russia, China, and India, then South Africa, which are all BRICS countries, as well as a few neighboring countries. Of course, in countries with high prevalence of HIV, we also find high prevalence of TB. Right, as a general rule, although where we are in the Western Cape, it's an exception. There are relatively high levels of TB due to other reasons, and not primarily due to that link with HIV. And one more. The sexual debut, the age at which young people start to have sex, was mentioned that perhaps that's dropping to as low as 10. Again, the evidence that we have does not support that. The idea is to talk about in general, on average. In the last survey, it was like both sexes, on average, the majority were beginning to have sex when they were 17 years of age. Yes, there are some who start early, and there are indeed some who start much later. But on average, it's about the same in both sexes, as from the 24th survey. And lastly, the comment about DBE, I had alluded to that as one of the departments which is funded for the HIV AIDS response, particularly through the Life Skills Program. But in addition, there are other departments, for example, Correctional Services, a few research, apart from those which were mentioned earlier. But above all, nearly all government departments do allocate some of their own funding to internal HIV programs. I think if you add all those little pockets, perhaps it's a bit much more than just what goes through the Department of Health and funding. Thank you.
Prevention needs to be used more broadly and
start changing individual behavior to more than drink, smoke drink, and eat foods that are high in salt and high in fat.
Could we keep going?
Sure. that's a very tricky one, and I think that the Shura talked about the model that that we have can work well for a model, and we need to look at all the processes and process issues around the issuing of these grants. But I think there is data that